Welcome to Real Paranormal Activity, the network. Entertainment you'll enjoy.
You are listening to an RPA production, where people gather. LaFoss Corporation, LLC.
Hi, everybody, and welcome to the show. This is Dave Emmons. It's the Strange Reality Show, and we have strange stories, but we also have a lot of basically factual stories. I don't think they're all strange. I think a lot of conspiracies, like, the ones I've been hearing for the last 4 or 5 years, 60% of them have been proven out to be true. So, what's going on here? You know, that's the thing. I have a guy, I've been looking forward to this guy. He's got a heck of a background and a heck of a writing background. And I wrote 4, beginner type books, but I think they're good. I think one's not doing so well, but the other still look okay. But this guy here, he's a master at it. And I just think that I can learn just from reading his books. I can learn something from his writing. And we're talking to Ron Felber tonight on The Strange Reality with me, Dave Emmons. And Ron Felber is a graduate of Georgetown University, Loyola University, and Drew University, where he earned his doctorate. He began his career writing stories for True Detective magazine and iconic Nick Carter. And I do remember that series. While working as a deputy sheriff transporting federal prisoners, The Runaway earned Ron and the United Press International Award for Fiction. He was the recipient of the Albright Award for his nonfiction bestseller, Mojave Incident. We'll talk about that. Some of his books have made their way to film and television, including The Mojave Incident, 2, Dot Tori, The Double Life of the Mafia Doctor, and The Hunt for Kun Sa. I guess I pronounced that properly. Okay. His most recent title, The Unwelcomed, and this looks like a real winner. I mean, I'm looking at the cover and it looks really mysterious. It's kind of like that Men in Black type of flavor to it. But his most recent title, The Unwelcomed, The Curious Case of Clara Fowler. He knows this stuff. He's been studying it and he got it from some real powerful people in Hollywood as writers. It's based on a true medical case history passed along to him by William Peter Blatty. Those who remember The Exorcist should remember this guy. He's an author of The Exorcist. Ron Bach's Golden Gloves, oh my, don't want to mess with him tonight, holds a blue belt in Brazilian jiu-jitsu and was CEO of a major manufacturing company for more than a decade. He teaches creative writing at Drew University's Casperson School of Graduate Studies in Madison, New Jersey. The film and television rights for Ron's latest effort, The Unwelcome, The Curious Case of Clara Fowler, are available through, and then he makes some names, and I might mention this if he wants me to. I'll stop right there with that information. But as you can see, Ron Felber is a professional, and he is since I've been writing now, that, you know, I'm really dumbfounded to really have Ron on this show. He's got a great background, and he has, oh man. Okay, let's turn Ron loose. Ron Felber, welcome to the show, buddy.
And hi, Dave.
Yeah, I'm glad to have you.
Good to be here.
Yeah, you too, buddy. What's going on with you now, and what about in the bio that I might have missed, some things that you do? Have you ever played music or anything like that? You look like you've
got a little bit of everything. No, I have. I play a little drums, but that's it. My son is a very good guitarist. Both my sons are musical. They play a number of instruments, guitar and piano and drums. But that's one set of talents that did not go my way.
Well, I was taking a shot at that because you got a background that's terrific. I mean, I'd love to have that kind of background, especially in writing. I'd really like to get into the writing just like
sure.
You.
No, I've been doing it. I've been doing it since the sixth grade. Literally, I wrote my first short story in the sixth grade, and I was publishing short stories in my brother's high school magazine when I was in grammar school.
Mm-hmm.
So I probably published, by the time I was 17, probably 30 or 35 stories. and essays, and I won an award for best short story in high school, and then got a scholarship to Marquette University for 1 year, and then I wound up going to Georgetown, transferring to Georgetown after that.
Wow. You got the background, you got the academia, you got the experience, and you used to tell me about a veteran you was talking about
Yes.
that you had met. He had Agent Orange, and he has some lung difficulties. I won't go into any more details unless you want to, but Ron sounds like a great guy that's working with vets, and he loves vets, and he's a patriot, and I admire that too in him. Ron, is there anything else you want to add about that bio before we get into talking about some of this,
No,
some of these books that are going to be
I think
great?
we covered a lot of bases there, Dave.
Okay. Yeah, we're not playing baseball. I wish I was when it comes to writing books like you. I mean, I wish I had you looking over my right shoulder and smacking me on the head, saying, "No, don't write that. Don't write it." But
Well, you know, I teach writing. So
yeah,
I
I know.
teach
That's what I
writing
know.
at Drew University to graduate students there. Most of these guys are older, and they're usually in their 30s, sometimes older than that, sometimes in their 50s, and they're going for their doctorate. But it's a lot of fun. And some of them are really talented. Everybody has a story, and some are better than others. But occasionally, and that would be one out of 10 or maybe even 20, just has a really on the mark story. And for example, there's a guy in my class who's a New York detective. And you know, he is writing a fiction story based on a true story about fentanyl and the cartels. And since he's really been involved in those, I mean, you know, he has all the detail, and he knows all the people involved in the case. And I'm delighted to work with somebody like that, because and help them, hopefully help them get their book published, you know.
I think that what you're doing, and you've had some TV experience, and your books have been involved in some of that. That's great. I mean, I'm hoping that this unwelcome for you, I'm just hoping that this is going to be a screenplay, and you'll get that on the movies, and because it looks really great. Let me show people the cover. Right there, that's the
Yeah.
cover, the unwelcome Ron Silver, and it does look a little bit like the Men in Black, doesn't it? It's a
Kind of
mysterious image.
creepy.
Yeah, kind of creepy.
But
Yeah.
it's a creepy story. You know,
Yeah.
actually, they're doing, Dave, you'll get a kick out of this. They're doing the audiobook now. So they have an actor who's doing the different voices. And,
Right.
you know, one of the voices is a demonic voice. This book is about demonic possession, but a true story of demonic possession that took place in 1898 to 1904 and was studied by some of the premier scientists in the United States at the time. And so it's a legitimate case history, and it just almost jumps out on the page onto the screen. It's really just one of those stories that's absolutely intriguing.
Yeah. I wanted to go into, and actually your talking points are actually questions I would probably ask. So you made my job easier. That lets me know you're a great writer. Is demonic possession real? Let's talk about that. That was something I would ask you anyway, Ron. But Ron Felber, would you answer that for us?
Sure, of course. You know, as you mentioned in my biography, I transported federal prisoners for as a deputy sheriff for about 3.5 years, which was enough. And I met hitmen and terrorists and con men and rapists and serial killers. And yes, demonic possession is real. It doesn't necessarily mean, in rare cases, it shows up, it emerges in the spirit of an invading presence, invading the body of an individual. But let's put that aside for a second. You know, I've met, and I don't want to get graphic, but I've met guys, you know, a Hell's Angel, for example, that tortured a 12-year-old girl to death, tied her to a tree. And you meet somebody like that, and you know that this has happened before. This is something they do and they like. And you look into the eyes of somebody like that, and Dave, I tell you, demonic possession is real, because in their eyes, you can see the devil. And it's not a mental illness. It's not just somebody that's a bad person. This is somebody that enjoys hurting people. This is somebody that enjoys killing. This is somebody that really has, in my view, become evil incarnate. And that's really almost the definition to me of demonic possession.
Well, there is a song, In Excess, The Devil Inside. And it's actually the devil is inside of us. And if we allow it to take over, then we are possessed. Is that right? Or is it a spirit that comes from without, it comes from outside of us and comes in, or is it something that starts within us?
Well, that's a really interesting question, because even physicists now. I'm just finishing a book that was called "The Case Against Reality" by Donald Hoffman, and basically these are physicists. So there's some of the, I mean, Aldous Huxley, Francis Crick, physicists and writers that have really come to the conclusion that science can take you so far. At the end of the day, we know very little about what's real. What we see and say, "Oh, this is reality." Sir Francis Crick, who was the co-founder of DNA and won the Nobel Prize for Science, said there is zero possibility that what we see is really real. And in my view, most of what goes on in the world, this huge world that we know so little about in reality, is spiritual. I think that there literally is a battle that goes on between good and evil. And I think human beings are in the middle. And at some point in time, they make a choice. And in some cases, they make a choice to be saint-like, a Mother Teresa or some of the saints that you'll read about in the church. Or just maybe somebody you've met that is really just a good person. But on the other hand, most of us probably are somewhere in the middle. But then there's others, let's say a Jack the Ripper, or let's say an H.H. Holmes, who literally, in my view, surrender their soul and become evil incarnate. They represent evil and they do evil, and that is their mission on earth.
I heard, and this is something I guess in the spiritual realm, and I deal with a lot of people with talking consciousness and spirituality. I heard that you can't really sell your soul because it's not yours to sell. It's actually the creator's. So
Yes.
is that is what does that make any sense there, Ron?
I think this, and I think that there are exorcists Catholic in the Catholic Church that have talked about this. I agree. I think it's a choice. I think basically you succumb. There are vulnerable individuals that succumb to temptation. So temptation might be, well, I'm gonna eat this candy bar I shouldn't be eating. Or temptation might be, I'm going to steal this candy bar from, the candy store. That's the kind of temptation, and you surrender to it. But there are other temptations that by degree. And at some point in time, the degree literally becomes, I succumb to this temptation for power, for money, for pleasure, for whatever it might be, gratification. And that evil, what I succumb to is bigger than I am, and I become that evil, and that's possession.
That's possession. Let's get into the curious case of Clara Fowler. This
Sure, my favorite topic.
kind of kicks off the book and everything. Is evil real? Is it a metaphor for bad things people do, or does it prowl the earth like a living, breathing entity that possesses the souls of vulnerable humans? The Unwelcome begins with the arrival of a young Radcliffe student at the office of renowned psychotherapist Dr. Morton Prince. Pursued by a city marshal hell-bent on solving the murder of two infants strangled by her father, Clara Fowler relives the nightmare that was her childhood, exalted by visitations from Jesus Christ and the Blessed Virgin, cursed by the emergence of a demonic presence obsessed with her demise. What did all that mean? That could you tell us that story? You said, Ron, Mr. Ron Felber, tell us that story on that on Clara Fowler.
Sure. So there's a woman who was 22 years old, very bright and very almost saintly. She attended church regularly. sort of timid. As a matter of fact, Dr. Prince refers to her as the saint, you know, compared to the demon. But the saint, Clara Fowler, the original Clara Fowler, had visitations from Jesus Christ and from the Virgin Mary and was going to enter a convent. So she was at Radcliffe, but her real mission after college was to go into a convent and become a nun and devote her life to a religious calling. So that's the original person. Over time, all of a sudden, she starts to have nightmares. And in these nightmares, she is in processions with dark robed figures. She has demonic figures posted on her bed and around her room. She can't sleep because of the terrible nightmares. She's afraid to go to sleep. When she tries to eat food, she sees maggots on her plate and worms and things. She doesn't eat. So basically, she's not eating, she's not sleeping, she has these horrendous, very real nightmares. And she goes to the doctor because she's absolutely fatigued. They called it neurasthenia at the time. And this would be a condition where somebody's just totally worn out. They're just totally burnt out. So she goes to a general practitioner who's also a famous doctor, Putnam, the famous Putnam family in Boston, Jackson Putnam. And Putnam originally thinks, well, diet, you know, help her sleep, some bromide, maybe some kind of sleeping sedative, the standard things a doctor might do. But then she starts talking about these visitations, and she starts talking about these nightmares, and they're so real that now the doctor, the original doctor, says, you know, this is way out of my league. You know, if I didn't know better, this woman he's dealing with demonic possession. She speaks in a man's voice suddenly. She gets very violent around religious articles. She has incredible strength. And the regular doctor, Putnam, says, you know, this is beyond my pay grade. And so Morton Prince, Dr. Morton Prince, who was one of the pioneers of psychiatry, and William James, who was really a famous, the father of abnormal psychology, both Harvard Medical School graduates. Prince talked at taught at Tufts Medical School, and James, William James, taught at Harvard Medical School. Prince had a protege, Dr. Waterman, and the heir to the Waterman Penn dynasty and fortune. And then he brought in to study this woman because when Putnam tells him about it, these are all the symptoms of demonic possession. He said, I know this sounds crazy, and if we were in medieval times, we'd be discussing this and we'd be talking about demonic possession. So I don't know what's going on with this woman, but she displays all these symptoms. So he organizes this team. William James, Prince is the lead, Dr. Morton Prince, George Waterman, his protege, and he brings in Richard Hogson, who is a president of the Society of Psychical Researchers and a spiritualist. He also brings in Leonora Piper, who is a clairvoyant. And the reason he does this is because spiritualism at the time had about 9 million followers in the United States and Europe. Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, the Sherlock Holmes author, Charles Dickens, Madame Curie, Pierre Curie, who invented X-rays or discovered X-rays. So, I mean, physicists, scientists, famous writers were spiritualists. They believed that you could contact the dead and there was a spirit world. So because of that, he put this team together. They studied this woman. And again, the voice would change to a man's voice, this explosive, deep voice, bass voice. Her face would actually remold into a different face, this hideous expression. She would speak in different languages that she couldn't possibly know, incredible strength. And they studied her. And because they were scientists, you get a real insight into this the symptoms of this disease, or whatever you want to call this phenomenon. For example, the demonic presence could not feel pain, was immune to pain, needed no food, needed no sleep. It was up 24/7, totally conscious 24/7. No illness, no fatigue, just a totally separate being occupying the body of this woman.
Now, I wanted to ask you, and I know you mentioned William Peter Blatty that's wrote The Exorcist. I want you to touch up on him, but also not too far from me in St. Louis. This is where the original story of The Exorcist supposed to have started. And it was actually a boy, they said, a young boy instead of a girl. So they used a girl for, I guess, more drama or whatever. But did this person, this girl, was she kind of what? Was that the story that Blatty was taken after in St. Ron?
Basically, there was a story, and it wound up in St. Louis, you're correct, but it started in Maryland in 1949. So what happened was there was a newspaper article, a small article in one of the Washington newspapers when Blatty was a student at Georgetown University. And he was writing, wanted to be a writer, and actually started out writing comedies. He invented Inspector Clouseau
Oh,
from A Shot in the Dark
yeah, that's a good
and
one.
Pink Panther.
Yeah.
That was he and Blake Edwards invented that character. So anyway, he knew he wanted to be a writer, and he saw this little article in the paper about this boy who wound up being treated in a hospital in St. Louis, but was his home base, his hometown where he grew up, was Maryland. And he said, this is a fascinating article. He put it in his wallet and just kept it there. Just kept it there. And years later, many years later, meaning the 1970s, not 1949 or 1950, he had been writing A Shot in the Dark and Promises, Promises, and a lot of Danny Kaye movies and stuff like that, comedies. It dried up for him. All of a sudden, that kind of humor, that subtle Peter Sellers kind of humor, was out. It just did, it didn't, they didn't make movies like that anymore. And so he found himself basically unemployed and said, gee, I don't want to drive a truck. I want to be a writer, So what do I do? So he pulled out his little article and said, I'm going to do it. I'm going to do a serious book, and it'll be The Exorcist.
And this story was actually true. I think you
Yeah, that's
make
correct.
notes
And
that.
by the way, the Clara Fowler, the unwelcome, the curious case of Clara Fowler. Clara Fowler was one of the cases that he studied while he was researching for The Exorcist, to write The Exorcist. And many of the stories within The Exorcist, the episodes within The Exorcist, were sort of a culmination of the 1949 case and also the Clara Fowler case.
So he got involved, and he found another niche that he got into, the scary stuff, the spooky stuff. And that movie, did they actually, I mean, they showed this young girl turn her head around all the way around. Did this real story, did the possessed guy or young boy, did he do that, Ron?
Yes. As a matter of fact, what this is where Blatty was with that. He couldn't open the records because the Catholic Church wouldn't allow it for privacy reasons. Because the boy was cured after the exorcism and went on to live a normal life. And so the exorcist being as huge as it was, imagine if somebody said, oh, well, this is the kid and this is where he lives now. So the church wouldn't open up the actual records, but what he did get to do was to interview the exorcist. And through interviewing the exorcist, he was able to get details about what happened during that those procedures, during those rituals.
And you were privy to knowing Mr. William Blatty, or
It's a great story. I mean, for me, I'm delighted about it, and more delighted right now because of the book. In 1972, which shows you how old I am, I was a sophomore at Georgetown, and they were filming The Exorcist. So outside of my dorm, there was some bars and this and that, the Tombs it was called, and on this street, M Street, on M Street, and I think it was M Street and whatever. Anyway, on this particular street where there was the Tombs and a couple of stores and whatnot, they were filming. So they had fog machines and all the rest, and it was all cordoned off so you couldn't meet anyone, but they were filming. I had my first novel that I had written. It wasn't very good. It was autobiographical, as most first novels are, sort of a love story. And I said, I'm gonna. I had had some success with short stories. I mentioned I won an award for one of my short stories in high school and all.
How
So I
many
said,
words is
now.
that? How many words are short stories that you're talking about, Ron?
Well, I wrote maybe 35, published maybe 35 short stories, I think. Maybe, yeah, at least that and articles. And so I had my first book. Now, I typed it myself. It was on, raggedy paper and had typos all over the place, but this was my first novel, And you know what that's like, being a writer. This is my first book.
Not as
But
good as you, but I do know what no being a writer.
and now I've got William Peter Blatty, whose book has been on the New York Times bestseller list, number one, for 56 weeks. So if you think I didn't want to meet this guy and give him my book, so I said, I'm gonna meet him. It was not an easy task because they were busy working, and I'm sure a lot of people wanted to meet him. So what happened was I did a little research, and maybe this goes back to my police days, or was a predecessor to my police days, but I did some detective work and found out that he had an office across the Key Bridge over the Potomac, and not far from Georgetown, right over the bridge, at the Key Bridge Marriott. And so I went there, and he had an office. Of course, he wasn't there; he was working or whatever, filming, and so with Billy Friedkin and his crew. But there was an admin there, an administrative assistant. By the way, a very beautiful woman. So he picked his admins well. So
That's a Hollywood type of
yeah,
situation.
exactly. So I come in, and I'm this, goofy college guy, and there's this gorgeous woman sitting at a desk in a beautiful hotel suite. And I say, I have this book, and I would like to give it to William Peter Blatty. I'd like to give it to Mr. Blatty. He said, "Well, that's not possible, but I'll take it and I'll put it in the back here." And so she points, and there's about 40, 50, 60 manuscripts, all a mountain of manuscripts that people have given her or him somehow, mailed from France, from England, from Germany, from all over the world. And I go, "Uh-oh, this isn't good,
That's what Hollywood's all about. They got
This
stacked
isn't
up.
good." So I said, "Look, how many of those 70 people came to this office to hand deliver their manuscript?" She said, "None." I said, "Exactly." I said, "Look, Bill Blatty was a student just like me, 30 years ago or so, or 25 years ago. So he went to this school on a scholarship, grew up in New York, in Hell's Kitchen, New York. I grew up in Newark, New Jersey. He got here on scholarship. I got here on scholarship. I'm just like him, except the time is different. If he thinks back 25 years, I am like him. So what I'm asking you to do is tell him that. Say this guy came, he said, he has a background very similar to your own. He wants to be a writer, and he came here. Please read the manuscript. If you'll pass that message along, I'll be forever indebted." She said, "I'll tell you what. I'll give it to him, and I'll tell him roughly what you said, and then that's that." And I said, "Well, here's my phone number and my address and all." So I go back for Thanksgiving vacation to New Jersey, where my parents lived and I grew up. And I get a phone call on Thanksgiving Day, and it's Bill Blatty. He said, I really liked your manuscript. I read every word of it, and I'd like to meet you." And I go, "Oh man, that made my Thanksgiving, as you can imagine." So we did meet. When I got back, we met. He met at his office. He was very, very kind, I would say. The manuscript, wasn't great. It was the best I could do at the time, but I knew that it wasn't great. But he liked it a lot. He said, this is, you've got real talent. And you could be, he said, you have the brains and the talent to be a fine novelist. So I said, well, that's pretty good. So he said, I can't help you with this. It's really not publishable. It's too personal and, it's just not commercial at all. He said, but I'll tell you what, I will give you my card and I move a lot. I have several houses. I will have my secretary always tell you where I am. So if I sell a house and move, you'll get a message that that's where I live now. You write another novel and I'll help you get it published. So,
Did he give you any directives on how he wanted it, or did
oh, well, we talked about an idea that I had at the time.
he?
And so I actually, this is crazy, but he gave me this story, the story for Clara Fowler. So I had this story. This is a story 50 years in the making, this book. So I wrote it, and actually, I wasn't intentional, but I wound up in California meeting him in Oscar Week, during Oscar Week in 1974, 2 years later, and I had my manuscript. So I went to the Beverly Hills Hotel where he was supposed to be staying, and it turned out that there had been death threats. So he moved. And so I got there and he wasn't there. So I talked to the hotel manager. He said, look, I shouldn't do this, but under the circumstances, this is where, this is the emergency address that he gave me. So I went to Sherman Oaks and I knock on the door, and who answers, but it's Tippi Hedren. Tippi Hedren from the
Oh
Birds.
yes.
So her
Yeah,
husband was
you were walking in tall cotton that time.
I was blown away. So she answers the door. I tell her my terrible story about flying there and he's not there and taking cabs and whatnot. And she says, come on in. And her husband was Noel Marshall, who was the producer of The Exorcist. So he was out with Blatty, probably celebrating, I guess. And they came back. We had dinner, and he looked at the book. He sent it around for me. And it didn't get published. I had written it like a documentary, and again, I just didn't have the talent to pull off a story as complicated and as with characters like William James, Sigmund Freud. It's very difficult to write in another time. It's easier to write in the future, sci-fi. It's easier to write in the present. But when you go back to 1898, what kind of cigarettes did people smoke? Did they wear boots? What kind of dresses did women wear? Were there horse and carriages? Were there cars coming onto it? Were there electric lights? You see what I mean? So you
Sounds like a lot of
really have
research.
to research.
Yes.
And so I had several books, several, maybe 10 books published since. Blatty and I stayed in touch, and it was really a great friendship. I really miss him. About 3 years ago, I said, I have all this research that I got from the Harvard Medical School library, where the case history for Clara Fowler was archived. This is where Blatty directed me. And I've got these photographs, I've got these letters, I've got all the transcripts of the psychiatric sessions and hypnotic sessions and whatnot. Letters between the doctors. I'm going to try to write it again. And so about 3 years ago, I said, let me take another crack at this. I'm older. I'm a much better writer than I was when I was 22 or 24, hopefully. And thank God I pulled it off. I think this is the best book I've ever written.
Well, I started writing. I was going to tell you earlier off air that I started writing at 72. That's been about what, 2 years, 2.5 years ago. And I had a rewrite on my first book. So it seems like, yeah, you do get your hands slapped sometimes to learn a lesson, but now you're teaching and you know how to do all this. Now, the book, The Unwelcome, it's a true story then. That's what we've been talking about, right, Robert?
It's a true, it's a it's a novelized version of a true story.
Okay.
And as I mentioned, when I tried to do it the first time, way back in 74 or so, I tried to do it just as a documentary, not changing a word, not, everything was literally pulled from files. Problem with that is it became a medical case history. Do you know what I mean? It read like a medical book, and that isn't what I wanted. So what I did was take the voice of a storyteller, which is a great lesson for writers. So, Dave, if you're sitting there at a bar and I'm sitting next to you at a bar, we both have a beer, we don't know each other. I tap you on the shoulder and I say, Dave, I just came back from Boston where I researched this case history that William Peter Blatty gave me, and you're not going to believe this is an incredible story. It starts out, you see, it's a voice. It's telling the story and letting the story grow in terms of emotion, in terms of fear. It's a very brightening story. My wife read the manuscript and didn't sleep for 3 nights. So
Oh my goodness.
it's
Now,
just.
do you speak through your main character? I mean, the main character was probably the possessed boy, but was there a character in the book that you spoke through? It's just like when I wrote my sci-fi, I'm speaking through my hero. Ron, is that okay, or is that good, or what?
Well, I tried almost all of the dialogue between the patient, Clara Fowler, and Morton Prince. And that's primarily, he was the primary doctor. The others were sort of advisors. Comes from transcripts. What I did do was modernize it. Educated people in particular, and uneducated people spoke different at the time. You know, it was two different societies. But Harvard graduates and whatnot. So you would have words like whilst. It would be very British almost, you know? And so obviously you don't want to write a modern book that people are going to be reading in 2024 and have this odd sort of sentence structure. So what I did was modernize the language, same message, same sentences really, but just modernized, let's say.
Now, going back to the Academy Awards, I know you have it in your notes. Did you go to the awards with Blatty?
So what happened after we went to had dinner at Tippi Hedren's house?
Oh,
He had a house
how lucky
in
were you?
yeah, really. We went to he invited me probably out of sympathy at the time to his house in Malibu. So the Academy Awards were that week, and so I stayed with them for I guess 3 days. I think about the fourth day was the Academy Award night. So I didn't go to the Academy Awards with him, but I drove with him to the Dorothy Chandler Pavilion where it was held in the limousine with them. And then they dropped me off at the Century Hotel, I think it was, where I was staying. But it was magnificent. It was really quite an experience that I'll never forget.
I'd love to go through that experience.
Yeah.
A while ago, I was pouring myself some water. I don't know, I'm drinking tonight. I'm dehydrated. I didn't drink any alcohol or anything. Well, I did yesterday too, but that's it. But getting back to this, this is Ron Felber, who's telling us some really neat stories about The Exorcist and William Peter Blatty and how he come about writing. And now he's a professor. He teaches writing, and he's talking to us and me. As you know, my personal interest in your writing is how could I write better when it, comes to, I know you don't have time for that, but I'm getting this. That's why I'm asking some of these questions about how
Yes.
you put yourself into a character. Do you speak for that character? And that kind
And by the way, let me answer your question more directly. I really tried to stick to what they said,
of.
but there is a detective involved in this story because this story is really like a murder mystery, a psychological thriller, as much as anything, because there are three murders involved, and this is real. As a matter of fact, the detective. And if there's a voice that I spoke to, maybe it's him. But his name is Rufus Bassett Hilliard. And the reason they call him Bassett is because he's like a basset hound. So he was the Fall River, Massachusetts city marshal who investigated the Lizzie Borden axe murders. And then actually just a few miles away from Lizzie Borden's murders. And 6 months removed, 6 months later, a farm worker named Juan Corriero committed an axe murder, murdered the wife of the farm owner brutally. Axe murdered her, very similar to that. So basically, you had a town, Fall River, that hadn't had a murder in 50 years, and three brutal murders within a very short distance. Oddly enough, and Hilliard, Rufus Bassett Hilliard, the city marshal, had investigated both of those. It turns out that Clara Fowler had two siblings, a brother named Charles and a sister named Bessie. And both of those died mysteriously under suspicious circumstances. So basically, Bassett now says this is really quite incredible. You have two infants murdered, at least the coroner thought that, and he thought that. So murdered, so let's say died under suspicious circumstances, but let's say murdered for the sake of discussion. You had Lizzie Bur Borden, who axe murdered her two parents. You had Juan Carriero, who murdered the wife of the owner of his boss's wife. And basically, now you have two, three, four, five murders within about a 5 mile radius within about 3 years in a town that had no murders for 50 years.
Wow. And this is part of what you're saying. And you said, what did all this mean? And how do these murders link with the serial killings of Jack the Ripper and H.H. Holmes? The answer the grizzled lawman discovers is more shocking than he could ever imagine. And that's what you're talking about. And
Yes.
George Norrie said this, the unwelcome should be a read with an open mind and all the lights on in the house. That's
Yeah.
Coast to Coast AM, George Norrie. And like I said, you've been getting accolades for this book, and it to me it's very interesting, and all the work that you put in this, I know as writing my own books, I know how much work you have to do in research. Research is a lot
I
of work.
hired a detective, Dave, actually, to get because Prince actually disguised all of the names and whatnot in a book that he published called Dissociation of a Personality in 1906. But he disguised all the names. And even when I went to the records, they were all blacked out and redacted. So it was difficult to really get to the bottom of things. But once I got the name Clara Fowler, then I could get her parents, then I could find out about her brother and sister. And I could start putting the pieces together of what has got to be just one of the more incredible stories of the 20th century.
Now, how does this book, The Unwelcome, differ from the, I guess, the William Peter Blatty book, being possessed? Does it have, did William Blatty see a difference in your book and your writing and his story, of demonic possession of this young girl?
Well, they're quite different because one is, Blatty's book, The Exorcist, he says this is fiction. So this is, a composite of different stories that he's put together. And so there was no Kinderman, Lieutenant Kinderman, as there was in this, and so there was no Damien Karras. These are invented characters. My characters aren't invented characters. This is a true story, a novel based on a true story.
Okay, so I don't have to tell the platforms, the internet platforms, that this is just for educational purposes only and entertainment purposes only. This is true, and I'm glad
That's right.
you're saying that. That's great. It's a true book researched with
As a
a.
matter of fact, I'll tell you, this is the book that this is published in 1906. It's called Dissociation of a Personality. And Prince documented much of what went on in this case in this book that was published in 1906. However, like I said, he disguised the names and he left out a lot of detail, for example, the murders. And there's a reason for that. As it turns out, Clara Fowler married his protege, Dr. Waterman, and became, once she was cured, became a socialite in Boston, one of the shining lights of Boston high society, with her Harvard educated husband, who had a great practice right on Beacon Street in Back Bay, Boston, Beacon Hill. And so he disguised her name and didn't really want her discovered because she was cured, and became the socialite and wife of a very prominent doctor who really was his protege and wound up living just maybe 10 houses down from where Prince lived
Wow,
on
that's
Beacon Street.
yeah. And I've been seeing some of these people who's endorsed your book, Dr. Perry Caley, An Extraordinary Journey into the Uncharted Depths of Human Mind. And this is what got me excited about having you on. Also, I took a look at what was going on with you, and I look at all these people. Dr. Michael Fletcher, award-winning author of To Hunt a Holy Man. And so, you've had some people take a look at your work, and I know they just don't endorse anybody. I mean, they don't throw their names out there to anybody.
Well, actually, I have an endorsement from Bill Blatty.
Really?
A highly influential account that qualifies as jaw-dropping.
Oh, great. Yeah, Ron Felber, that's great. We're talking to Ron Felber, and we're talking about his book. And he's got lots. I mean, let's say lots of books. I don't know how many. I got them listed here. Some of them. We'll talk about maybe one or two of those that might interest you in talking about. Here's something that's in my wheelhouse, I guess.
Sure.
Get to this. Do aliens and demons have a lot in common, in your opinion? And alien abductions, Tilted Mojave incident?
I think the answer is yes. I'm not sure what the connection is, but there's definitely a connection. So, for example, in the Mojave incident, which I think you read, right? I think you read the Mojave
I
incident,
went through
anyway.
the synopsis of it. Yeah, it's a Mojave incident, and it's on sale now. It's on eBay actually now. And I saw that, a little bit about that, and that's why I'm talking about this alien
Sure.
abduction thing.
Well, th this involves an alien abduction in October of 1989, and a young couple who went camping and wound up in a horrible situation where they had this UFO experience. A UFO the size of a football field capped the valley that they were in. They were experimented on by these alien creatures, these alien beings. And there were three types. One was a gremlin type, almost like spiders or monkeys or that kind of thing, with red eyes, these glaring red eyes, very malevolent, even demonic, chaotic, frenzied, terrifying. And that would be the first kind of creature they encountered. The second kind they called the illuminated figures, and these maybe were 5 foot high or so, totally white light. They did have features the small noses, the holes for noses, the large eyes, but totally illuminated white light. And these were the scientists that actually surrounded, nine of them surrounded their camper that they were trapped in while they were experimented on through telepathy. And then at their worst moment, or when they thought that their kids were in dire jeopardy, when they thought that they were in hell, and their hearts were just leaping out of their chest, an angelic presence made an appearance out of the clouds, clearly feminine, and telepathically, "Don't worry, your children will be okay. You will survive this. Just have faith." So basically, you have the gremlin figures that are demonic. You have the illuminated figures that, let's call them the scientists or whatever, but then you have this angelic presence. If you think about the unwelcome, you have obviously demonic figures, and the demonic figures, at least some of them, the first that she starts to encounter, are a lot like the gremlins. The scientific illuminated figures, I'll just leave that one alone. But you have the angelic presence that they called their comforter, that comforted them in, when they thought they were going to
Ron,
die.
what did this angelic presence, what did it look like? Did it have a
It
robe?
looked like an angel.
Angel.
It looked like an angel. And so in the other case, so you have the demonic gremlins and you have a demon in the unwelcome, the Clara Fowler case. You have the Blessed Virgin, who serves pretty much the same figure, the same function as the comforter. in the Mojave incident,
Yeah.
meaning it'll be okay, just calm down, that you'll get through this, have faith. So there's definitely sort of this religious aspect to it. The other, aside from the angelic presence, the demonic presence, in both cases, they talk about this sulfurous smell. When the Hesses were trapped in this camper, they talk about like a drilling operation that was going on, a device, a triangular device that was scouring the desert basin, and this drilling sound and this smell of sulfur. Well, every time the demonic presence would come to Clara Fowler, there was this odor, this sulfurous odor. So the connections are there. I mean, they are, I think, more than coincidence.
I think I smelled, my buddy and I smelled sulfur when we saw our first UFO back in the early 60s. And a lot of people said, well, that was demonic. And I thought, well, nothing really demonic happened to me. I mean, it was more like a spiritual thing that happened and took a little while to regress and know that we were both on board that ship. It was only 35 feet off the ground and we were looking right at it. And, it was scary, but as kids being 13 and 14 years old, we liked those horror movies. So we go to the movies, we were afraid to look at the monster, but we wanted to go see the monster, just like this thing in the Mojave Desert. You have these people, and they were convinced that it was a demonic type situation.
Well, they weren't. No, they weren't. They weren't. But this is again the interesting thing. What they thought was this extraterrestrial, the UFO, the size of a football field. It's beaming lights down, picking things up. They wind up inside it, as it turns out. They're retrogressed. We had them retrogress. They talk about being inside the craft, but the comparisons, the parallels between them really exist. And I have to tell you, I was watching, for whatever reason, a couple nights ago, Unsolved Mysteries. It just came on. And what came on was a story about Fatima in Portugal,
Yes.
where the Blessed Virgin appeared to three children. And I didn't know much about that story, except there were three secrets, and the Virgin Mary appeared, and there were 30 some thousand people that witnessed the phenomenon. But again, getting back to the demonic and the spiritual and whatnot connection, I learned this. Just before the Virgin appeared to them, there were two great flashes of light. The Virgin Mary was like translucent. This beautiful angelic presence that was translucent and spoke to them telepathically. All right. The sixth time she appeared, these young girls, everybody doubted them and hated them, said, "We need a miracle. Prove to people that this is real." And so on the sixth visit, all of those things happen. The Virgin appears. And the sun does a dance in the sky and then comes shooting down at 30,000 people. It was raining and then stopped raining and their clothes were dry, supposedly. And then goes back. And that was the miracle. But if you think about that in terms of a UFO experience, a flash in the sky, a translucent figure, angelic, interdimensional, right? You've got the sun, but maybe it wasn't the sun. Maybe it was a UFO the
Right.
size of a football
Yeah.
field. How about that? And so again, you start putting this together. So the Hesses, the people that were involved in this Mojave incident experience, really had a bad aftermath. They suffered from sleep deprivation. They couldn't sleep, insomnia, sexual dysfunction, lack of appetite, lack of ambition. Just like once you've had this experience, you really want to go work again. It
Yeah.
just jumbles your reality. And so they became somewhat, well, they became religious. And they joined the Mormon Church. They were Mormons, but they intently now joined the Mormon Church and actually moved to Utah to be nearer Salt Lake City. And the bishop said, "You didn't have a UFO experience or an alien abduction experience. You had a demonic possession experience.
Okay.
So now, interestingly enough, if this guy Grush, the fellow that testified
Yes,
before
right.
the Congress, talking about extraterrestrials, talking about bodies, talking about recovery programs of UFOs, the vehicles, the crafts themselves, didn't talk about extraterrestrials. He talked about interdimensional, non-human entities.
Yeah.
But think about that. Interdimensional, not necessarily extraterrestrial,
Right.
interdimensional, non-human entities. Well, aren't angels interdimensional, non-human entities?
Right. Just like
Aren't,
spirits and ghosts and the
yeah.
poltergeist and the ETs, yeah, they're all come from another dimension. Yeah, sure.
So they're definitely tied together, and what it all means or how the pieces fit together, I can't say I figured that out yet. But if you ask me, are there comparisons? Are there comparables? Are there parallels? Absolutely, there are. Absolutely, there are. And it makes me wonder if, as Grush says or implies, that maybe these aren't extraterrestrial. Maybe these are time travelers. Maybe these are visitors from another dimension. I watched the physicist, Kakao, the Asian fellow, white
Yes.
hair.
Yeah.
You've seen him many times, I'm sure, on television. And he made an interesting statement. He said, when like these telescopes, Hubble, and they have the new one, takes a photograph, it's like looking through a straw. That's where the picture comes from. And you see, and then it's enlarged. And when it's enlarged from this peephole, this pinhole, really, you see hundreds of thousands, maybe millions of universes. Not galaxies,
Yeah.
not planets, not stars, universes. And so if you take that little piece and say, all right, what does the mass look like? What does the macrocosm look like? It's absolutely mind-blowing. And I think that probably if we really understood reality, it would blow our minds.
Yeah.
I don't think we could deal with day-to-day living.
Yeah, where some scientists saying we have 11 universes, but there's a lot more than that. And Michio Kaku, I think that's who
Yeah,
that
that's
is.
right. That's
Yeah,
right.
Dr. Michio Kaku. He's been on a couple of times, and
He's great.
yeah, he is. And he actually tells it like it is. He's a very conscientious guy, and he doesn't want to hide anything from people. And he tells the truth about what's going on in the universe and what's going on
Yes.
with ETs. He believes in ETs. He doesn't know
Yes.
exactly what, like you're saying, could they be holographic? I saw one that was in a holographic form. They come and they're there about 5, 7, 8 seconds, and then they're gone, but they're there long enough to scare the crap out of you.
Yeah, doesn't take much time to do that, huh?
When you get out of bed and you're going to the bathroom, you turn around and you look and you see this creature. It looks like a cobra in the face, and I said, "Oh my God, that scared me." I jumped out of that bed. I'm a big guy, but I think I leaped out of that bed. But
I reread Doors of Perception by Aldous Huxley, and he has a very interesting theory in there. He talks about the other world,
yeah.
and he says that the brain, you and I would think normally the brain, its job is to observe and interpret information. He says that's not the purpose of the brain. The purpose of the human brain through evolution is to filter out reality and leave behind the things that would allow you to eat, sleep, procreate, and that's about it. So at the end of the day, it's sort of like an icon. If you look at your face in a mirror, all you see is your face. And you can say, okay, this is a guy with a hat and he has these earphones, etc. All fine.
He's got a
Glass.
big head. He's got a big head too. You got
Glasses, whatever, but it doesn't tell you what are your thoughts, who are
Yeah.
your parents, what are your beliefs, what are your religious beliefs, what are your spirit, what is your politics, what have you gone through? What we see are like these icons. we don't really see the depth of real reality.
Right.
In my own belief, and Huxley's also, and Sir Francis Crick also, would say that there's a zero possibility that what we see is really real. So, what is really real? We don't know. But it seems to me what's really real has something to do with interdimensional and maybe extraterrestrial and spiritual beings.
Right. You're talking about, Ron, you're talking about like what a screen that they put up for us, a mental screen that
Yes,
is shape-shifting, and
exactly.
shape-shifting is also in there too. So I guess these ETs can shape-shift to anything they want to be. I guess angels can do the same thing. They can.
Certainly, demons can.
Yes. Okay. And a good question on your talking points here. Why do demons possess humans? Let's get into that. Why do they want us, Ron?
You know, there's a, if I can read a little section,
Sure,
there's
go ahead. Yeah.
now, this is, like I said, modernized. But this is the basic argument that the second consciousness put forward. So I dramatize it, but essentially, this is the dialogue. So Leonore Piper is the clairvoyant, and so Clara is in this demonic state. So they're dealing literally with another entity, a different person, Satan. So Leonora Piper goes like, why? She sputtered, demonic possession personality. Why do I bother with a pathetic blank like Clara Fowler? I do it because it's my job. God is dead, it bellowed suddenly in flame. Jesus is in hell. Yet moment to moment, we fight for the souls of humans, sometimes by the thousands, often one at a time, each a small or momentous victory. And we celebrate those victories, he swore. Truly we do. She utters, God, God. He said, a tired general, incompetent, blithering. Angels have lost confidence in them, knowing the power of the forces I command. It lowered its voice and spoke with scorn. I think the English would say he let his side down. It crept toward her. Another secret, it croaked. Most are borderline, but occasionally we come upon a special case. Borden, Holmes, the Ripper. Countless others whose names you'll never know, and these by their own choosing become me, evil incarnate, prowling the earth with one purpose, to reduce God's so-called creations to the brutish animals I know them to be.
Yeah, that sounds pretty deep there, Ron.
Powerful stuff.
That's some powerful stuff.
Powerful stuff.
Yeah, I but so demons possess us because they want our souls. They use it as food, or they use our energy.
I think something like that. Yeah.
So they're wanting our energy, and they like negative energy. They like to scare you and get that negative energy from you. That's what they feed on. That's what
But
our
you know, it's really interesting now that you mentioned this, it just occurred to me. But I mentioned when the Hesses were trapped in this camper and these illuminated figures were telepathically testing them, putting thoughts in their head, making them relive experiences. Basically, the experiences for the most part that they were reliving were terror. Terror.
Yeah.
So if somebody had maybe been sexually abused, they would relive that. So if somebody had was a hunter, which Steve was, he would be hunted. He would be skinned like an animal. And so the idea was a kind of torture, a kind of negative, for sure, negative experience.
I read an article, and it makes sense to me. It's like somebody steals your negative ions from your body. We have, we're electrical. We have negative,
Yes.
positive ions with us. And actually, when somebody steals your negative ions from you, they're actually like energy vampires or soulful vampires. They take that energy from you, and they can use it. And I heard that's what some ETs can do. And then what you're talking about with possession, that's what these demons do too. They suck our electrons from us. And if we stand barefooted on the ground, we'll get more electrons back into our bodies. And if we hug one another, we achieve more electrons. And if we're petting a dog and we have a dog as a pet, that gives us more electrons to in our body.
Yes.
But there are things that steal, your electrons and things that give you electrons that help make you have a balance. But if you get around this possession, like you're talking about, or around some certain ETs that shapeshift, they're going to steal your energy, and you're gonna go low. I mean, you're gonna be possessed. I mean, you're gonna, like you said, it's they're gonna go into, a demonic possession. Now, is demonic possession more common than what we hear about, Ron?
Actually, the Vatican, not so long ago, within the last 10 years, called a conference of exorcists and formed a team. And in the United States, let's say 20 years ago, there were a handful of practicing exorcists. Today, there are 150 of them. And the Vatican, and this goes on all over the world. If you were to go to YouTube just as a place to go, or the internet, and look up demonic possession, you would see Catholic priests performing or discussing exorcisms. Current. I mean, over the last couple of years, you would see actual exorcisms or film footage of exorcisms taking place in a church or a home, whether they be Catholic priests. And again, they beefed up that worldwide. Because demonic possession or cases are on a tremendous uprise.
Yes.
And that's not just Catholics. Jews would believe in demonic possession, and certainly Protestants would Christian Protestants would believe in demonic possession, and there are many exorcisms that go on.
I heard from a lot of these ghost hunters, believe it or not, that they when they come into possession and they get the permission of the parents or the people of the house, they have to bring in I guess a certified priest that does these, these possessions and these exorcisms. Now, I see this done in churches, regular churches, where I don't think a lot of times these preachers are qualified. And now, is that would that be your opinion too, that they should be experts and be kind of like certifiable, Ron, to do these?
I would think there's, well, I know at least in the Catholic faith, there's training, a deep training that goes on in terms of how to deal with these. I had a friend who is a psychiatrist who helped me actually with the Mojave incident. And did some actually gave me an endorsement for the book, The Unwelcome. And he said that he had dealt himself with a case similar to this, I mean, demonic possession, where he really ran out of explanations
Right.
and he wanted nothing to do with it. He said that he had been attacked. This person and his second personality, this demonic personality, was violent, crazy, and he was afraid for his life. And he said, "I will never, ever get involved in anything like this again."
Now, if you get too close, it's just like the priest in the show, The Exorcist. The same probably in your book, The Unwelcome. Is it possible that a priest or somebody performing the exorcism can actually be absorbed
Yes.
by the demon itself?
Absolutely. As a matter of fact, Aldous Huxley, I mentioned, who wrote Doors of Perception, also wrote a book called The Devils of Loudun. And this was a convent in France where there was an epidemic among the nuns of demonic possession. All of the things we talk about, and multiple victims. So four priests were sent to stem the epidemic and perform exorcisms. Of the four, three died within a year after the exorcisms, and the fourth became insane and spent the last 25 years of his life in a lunatic asylum.
Wow.
So even in with Prince dealing with this, Prince started to wonder and had thoughts like, "Am I curing this woman of a demon, or is the demon possessing me?"
Okay. Yeah, we've got to make that clear. It's not Prince the performer, but Prince
Yes,
the
Dr. Morton
Dr.
Prince.
Prince.
Yes, absolutely.
Right. Some people say hear you say Prince, say, oh yeah, okay. That you know
No,
I like him.
no,
But there were some mysterious things happen to him too. I don't want to
I
get
don't
into
doubt
that.
it.
Yes, don't doubt that these people are getting involved in demonic possession around the world and what's going on today. You kind of relate to what happened in this book with the possessions and the Mojave Desert thing. What do you think's going on now, Ron Felber? Well, how do you feel about what's going on now?
I think that we're being, and this is actually under hypnosis. And when retrogressed, Dawn Hess, one of the key figures that was abducted in the Mojave incident, says this in other words, but I'll say it in my words. I think that if you look at the original sort of flying saucers that were viewed in Washington State by the pilot in 19, I think 47, I believe. So they had these grainy photographs that everybody's seen that's involved with this, of the 9 UFOs or 7 UFOs and so it was a grainy photograph. Then I think we had other photographs that became more clear. Then we had in the 60s, you had Betty and Barney Hill and the first abduction. And now things get even closer and more, people become more acclimated to the idea. Then you have Whitley Strieber with Communion and his abduction that he writes, and it becomes a major bestseller, and people are very familiar now. Then you have John Mack, the Harvard professor, who studies in great detail and head of I think, the psychiatric department of Harvard University, who studies alien abduction and says they're real, and publishes his book. Then you have the Phoenix Lights, where people are talking like the governor, the former governor of Arizona, Fife Symington, literally talking about overhead, he and 1,000 other people observe, again, a craft the size of a football field. Absolutely unearthly is how he describes it. Awesome and unearthly. And then, more recently, you have the pilots from the various ships, Roosevelt, the Nimitz, where now you have top gun pilots and the commander of the top gun forces that are in the air, tracking these UFOs or whatever they are, call them UFOs, I guess, and with videotape, radar tracking. So it's kind of undeniable something's going on. Then you have Grush come forward. They have Senate hearings, and he talks about recovering spacecraft. If even 15 years ago, the Pentagon had put out footage of Top Gun pilots and UFOs that they say could perform things that were absolutely impossible and beyond their technological capability. Years, centuries maybe beyond what we were capable of. And these are the best pilots in the world, the best observers of aerial phenomenon, one would imagine, in the world. And people would have flipped out. This would have been, even 15 years ago, I think it would have been headlines. You say that today and show somebody that says, well, I don't know anything about it. Well, here, let me show you this video of Favor. Who talks about this on 60 Minutes, about what he saw, what this, it's not, it's otherworldly, it's not from this world, you see Grush. These are really competent, credible, the most credible people you could probably imagine, with footage, with radar tracking. People look at it and say, wow, that's pretty cool.
You know,
We are
Ron.
deep, we are acclimated. We're being acclimated to a major encounter with another world, or maybe more than one other world. But that's going on, and I think it's nearer than we think. When they asked Dawn Hess under hypnosis, when will this happen? And I said to her, in my lifetime. She said, how long will you live? I said, Then I said, how about my kid's lifetime? In your children's lifetime, there will be a contact, whether you call it alien, interdimensional, whatever words you want to use.
What I've been seeing is the disclosure. Now they're pulling back from actually going through with the total disclosure. They're dripping it on us. And the reason why, the powers to be, maybe even some evil powers. Now, this is for entertainment purposes only. I must advise the platforms that this is educational and entertainment purposes only, that the evil people in this world, in which, you know, they consist of the rich, they're influential, and
Yeah.
there's a lot of people that are getting in trouble right now. And I don't want to say names or anything, because
No, you don't. No.
that would be bummed out. But this is where the battle of good and evil, and you mentioned it earlier in the show.
I did.
We are battling the evil right now on this planet, and I don't know where it's all coming from, to tell you the truth, Ron.
Nor do we know where it's going.
No, where it's going. But I do know that somebody's holding up a disclosure. Now, most people will believe orbs in the sky and flying. They've seen videos, but they don't think ETs come down here on Earth, and they don't think they're interacting with people, but they are, because I'm a witness to that.
Well, you know, Gordon Cooper, the astronaut, is very vocal. You can go into YouTube and see him, an interview with him where he says he's encountered beings, seen them, you know, not just UFOs, but actually non-human entities. And, you know, was very upfront about it, said he filmed it, you know.
Now, I've got a list of books here, and we're running up on time. I want you to kind of, you know, spill out some information on your newest book, and also the Mojave Incident. I know a lot of my listeners would be interested in just a quick synopsis of that book. And you have Il Dottore. Is
yes,
that how you pronounce it?
Il Dottore, The Double Life of a Mafia Doctor
And a Mob Doctor. Okay. Now, those books are out too. So those are, I guess, self-explanatory, Mob Doctor. And
yes. Yeah, that goes back a little ways.
Okay.
And Mojave Incident is available still on Amazon. You can get it on Amazon or Barnes & Noble, and it's still in print. So there's, you know, it's not a problem getting copies of it. And The Unwelcome is now available, actually just last week. It's available on Amazon and Barnes & Noble and Thrift Books, or wherever you want to buy a book. You can pre-order it.
And people, I would advise you to, now, the Mojave Incident, were their names ever mentioned, Ron?
Yes. Originally, we disguised the names, but then they came out and did a couple of shows and were interviewed. Their names are out there. It's Steve and Dawn Hess. Yeah.
Okay. Did they ever have repeat visits?
Well, they did it initially. I didn't follow it beyond a point. But when they returned from their original experience, yes, they had repercussions that followed.
Yeah, I would advise people that into the ET thing also, and all any of Ron Felber's books. I want you to take a look at them, because this is interesting.
You know, Dave, I have a cover here that I can show. Maybe it's a little more clear. Can that? Is
Yeah,
that something
that's a
that
little
people
clearer
can see?
than The Unwelcome, Ron Felber. Yeah, there you go. Yeah, that I had one that I tried to pump it up larger and larger, and I couldn't get it up any larger.
Well, actually, this isn't really a book. It's the cover.
Yeah.
Because the book, you can pre-order it right now, which I'm really hopeful people do. Because, as you know, if the pre-orders are significant, it's a larger printing, and more books are distributed. So it really helps in terms of book sales and distribution.
Right. So,
please go out and order it.
Yeah, people interested in Mojave Desert with the ETs and everything. Ron's a great writer, so I'm sure if you pick up these books, you're going to get the essence of what he's thinking. And also this new book, The Unwelcome. Who you think would be really interested in The Unwelcome? I mean, we're all interested in, I guess, evil and possession, and we're afraid of it, but would people gain some knowledge out of what it's all about, Ron? I know you're an excellent writer. I haven't read the book through, of course, but I think if people got it, they would know what this whole thing is about. Is that what you would say, Ron? Could you sum it up?
Yeah, I would say, I mean, if you were going to ask me, it reads like a novel, because it's novelized. So it's sort of a psychological thriller. It's a murder mystery. And it would be akin to maybe a Dean Kuntz book or a Stephen King book.
Right.
In that it's a terrifying story. As a matter of fact, I think one of the reviewers called it perhaps the most frightening book on demonic possession ever written.
There you go. There's going to be, I can see that in a movie before long, Ron.
Well, we hope so.
Yeah, and yes, of course, and I will, I'll talk my people up, my viewers up on this book, and I think it's a great book, and it looks scary, mysterious, just like a lot of these people have said. But I just, I like having you on the show because you are a professional writer, experienced writer, and not saying not a lot of people aren't, but I'm just saying that your books are, if they take a read of your book, they know they're going to be reading something of quality. That's what I'm
Yeah.
saying.
Well, like I said, this was 50 years in the making. It took me a long time to get the voice and the proper narration for a story as powerful and as intriguing as this.
Yeah. And also hiring a detective, that's
I
going,
did,
yeah,
yeah.
that's going beyond the scheme of a writer a lot of times, but yeah, have you met any other I guess stars or influential people since you've been writing this and you got this book out, Ron?
Like I said, I have several really good endorsements from various writers. Really, what I've been doing is first of all, when you're writing, as you sort of dig in and become a bit of a hermit. And
Yes.
now I'm in a more promotion mode,
Right.
sort of doing some talk shows and telling people about this great story. But I have had some writers that I met. I became friendly with Norman Mailer,
Yeah.
I guess Pulitzer Prize, two Pulitzer Prizes, a National Book Award. So he's one of the great writers probably in the 20th century, and I got to know him a little bit. I have a couple letters from him that I really treasure.
Yeah.
And of course, Will Bla William Blatty. Ward Dorrance was somebody that was one of my instructors. And that was a great experience. But yeah, those are some of the people that I mentioned Tippi Hedren, who
Yeah.
we met.
Yeah.
And
Wasn't
yeah,
she in Alfred
I've been
Hitchcock?
fortunate that way.
Yeah, she was in Alfred Hitchcock movies, a couple.
Yes.
Yeah, I remember her very well. And you went to dinner at her house. That must be neat. That's
That
not
was fun. It
yeah,
was
that's nice.
it's something you don't forget.
Yeah. In closing, we're about to, I guess a few minutes before closing. Could you tell us how we can find out more about you, Ron Felber, on you have a website or books
I
that
do. It's an easy one. It's just ronfelber.com.
RonFelber.com. Okay.
So that's as easy as it gets, I guess.
And then
And if you go to Amazon, you can see a lot about my books. And for The Unwelcome, you'll see the cover. And it gives a very lengthy description along with some reviews that might be of interest to people. It's available on Kindle and it's available on quality paperback now. It will be available soon on ebook, and the audiobook is being developed right now. As a matter of fact, it's scary as hell. They have the actor with the different voices. So I played it because we were just picking out actually what actor it would be that does the voices. And I said, "My God, that's creepy. That's
You
creepy."
gotta have that voice. But when I looked you up on a page, this is what I come up with, a list of books, and people can see the same page. And when they bring it up on Amazon,
Yes.
Google, just Google the name, and you'll find a lot of stuff. Ron Felber, so nice having you, and I thank you so much for being on the show. And
That was a lot of fun. I really enjoyed it. It's great discussion.
I think you're gonna have a great book, and I think I'm looking forward to the movie in about a year. It'll take that long to get it processed.
Actually, I'm talking to a fellow tomorrow that makes movies.
Okay. Well,
So
God
we'll see
bless
how
you.
it goes.
God bless you. I ho hope the synchronicity follows you, and we're lucky to have you on this show. And
Thanks so much, Dave. It's been a pleasure. You're a great guy.
well, thank you so much. And you've been listening to Dave Evans' Strange Reality and Ron Felber, a great writer, and he's going to be a movie script writer maybe. Well, he ain't gonna write the script, but he's got the book because it's gonna be a movie before long. So get the book and read it before it comes out in movie. Thanks everybody for joining in and watching this program, and we appreciate it, and we appreciate Ron, his expertise in writing. I do. I know. I'm extremely jealous. Okay, bye bye.
Okay, thank you, Dave. Thanks so much.